Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. Dr. Roger Landry, president of Masterpiece Living, is the author of Live Long, Die Short, a guide for authentic health and successful aging. With a rich conversational style, Live Long, Die Short gives us a deeper understanding of what it takes to be authentically healthy and of the profound negative effects of modern-day stress and our need to nurture all aspects of our magnificent human nature.
The fact that to the extent someone is engaged with meaning and purpose in their life, that makes all the difference in how we age, how much we have to consume medical costs, and how we're impaired by chronic disease.
Dr. Landry is a preventive medicine physician who specializes in empowering older adults to take control of their own aging. He is a nationally known speaker on successful aging, and he has keynoted and presented at local, state, and national conferences on aging.
Relative to retirement, I think we have to redefine retirement as to what that means. It should be more like the next stage of my life. And I think public policy ought to be such that there is an easy way to remain engaged or to go to a new stage of your life where you can mentor or you can guide or you can have more intergenerational contact to help youth and for you to be energized by that.
Dr. Landry is a lecturer, researcher, and consultant. He has written extensively and is frequently called upon as a media expert on the topic of successful aging. Please join me in welcoming Roger Landry, MD, to the Not Old Better Show.
Welcome to the Not Old Better Podcast. It's time for this week's featured guest on the Not Old Better Podcast. And now your host, Paul Vogelsang.
Dr. Roger Landry, thank you very much for joining us here on the show. I very much appreciate it. It's wonderful to talk to you. I have to tell you, I was a little bit anxious to have you here for a number of reasons. The first is I'm 59, and the second is I only scored 87 on the inventory assessment in the book. So we'll touch on that. But firstly, the idea that a person who's now past 55, again, I'm 59, I'm interested in what's become of us as a people. You know, in my research for the interview, I read that often now many of us are going to be living to 100 and beyond. So why should we be retiring at age 65? It just seems absurd. We have rules here in the state of Virginia that a Supreme Court justice, for example, which is our highest court in Virginia, has to retire specifically 20 days after their 73rd birthday. And the legislature had a chance to change that. They didn't. The governor said that he's not quite sure that's such a great idea. I don't know. It just seems like that's a mistake, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. In my mind, it is. First of all, Paul, no need to be at all anxious. It is my honor to be with you, and thanks for all the great work that you do. I certainly agree that, yes, we are going to live longer. And it is a particular hot topic with me as to how we manage or treat or view our older adults in our society. For the most part, since the Industrial Revolution, we've pretty much been marginalizing them. You know, 65 was an arbitrary age that the Germans in the late 19th century chose to award their version of Social Security. They just happened to pick it. Of course, people were only living to be about 49 then, so they thought they were safe, but somehow that got chiseled in there. But, you know, every society prior to that, and our blue zones today, if you know blue zones, these are places identified by Dan Buettner where people age, they get old, but they also age in a very vital way. We see something different from our pre-industrial revolution societies and these blue zone societies where the older adults are viewed in a much different way as treasures, really. And blue zones, they're called cultural treasures. And it is their wisdom and guidance that has guided us as a species for eons prior to the Industrial Revolution. And then you add to that the fact that when someone doesn't have meaning and purpose in their life, if they're not considered of value or they don't feel that they're making any kind of difference and it doesn't matter whether they get out of bed or not in the morning, this is deadly for someone. It makes them higher risk for all the major chronic diseases, from heart disease to dementia to cancer. And so that combination of an aging society, also combination of demographics, how we treat our older adults now versus the way we used to, and the fact that to the extent someone is engaged in it with meaning and purpose in their life, that makes all the difference in how we age, how much we have to consume medical costs, and how we're impaired by chronic disease. And, you know, so we're in many ways going in the wrong direction. So relative to retirement, I think we have to redefine retirement as to what that means. It should be more like the next stage of my life. And I think public policy ought to be such that there is an easy way to remain engaged or to go to a new stage of your life where you can mentor or you can guide or you can have more intergenerational contact to help youth and for you to be energized by that youth. So there's no question, there's a lot of human capital that we are just pushing off to the side and not using. And as we age as a society, we're not going to be able to continue to do that.
Well, I want to remind everybody, this book that you've written, Dr. Landry, is just terrific. It's Live Long, Die Short, A Guide to Authentic Health and Successful Aging. I read the book. It is terrific. And inside the book is an assessment. And I mentioned this right at the top of the show that I went through the assessment process. I scored an 87. Now, what score should somebody like me aspire to? How should I get there? Is it too late for somebody like me? And maybe give our listeners a little bit of a description of what this inventory assessment's all about and how it ties in with this idea of being more authentic, but successfully aging.
Well, it is absolutely never too late for anyone or too early to think about lifestyle and the fact that knowing that that's the major determinant in how we age and trying to get some idea of how our lifestyle that we're living may be putting us at risk and what we can do about to lower those risks. And that's what you're referring to. That questionnaire in the book was all about being able to take a snapshot of your lifestyle, very easy questions to answer, and then getting some sort of sense that perhaps you're ignoring some aspects of your life that are putting you at risk for chronic disease or impairment and at some long, drawn-out aging process. The title of the book, Live Long, Die Short, is about the die short part in public health terms is called a compression of morbidity. Morbidity is when we're sick and impaired, and we'd like to compress that time. So we'd like to be going concerns longer and longer. And when our time comes, to have it fairly quick. And that's good for society. It's good for quality of life. It's good for healthcare costs. It's good for families. It's good for everyone. I think everyone would choose it. So in order to do that, since the MacArthur research in the late 90s of the last century and all subsequent research tells us that our lifestyle is the major determinant in how we age, 70% as much, then we should be paying attention to that. And it's not just the physical part, which we tend to focus on in our society. It's the physical. It's the intellectual. It's the social. It's the spiritual, in fact. The spiritual referring to having meaning and purpose in your life. So I think a lot of times we delude ourselves into thinking we're doing it all. You know, we're being holistic and we're paying attention to all aspects of your life. But as you probably saw, although 87 is a great score, Paul, congratulations.
Well,
the first time.
Got it.
But I think you can tell me, I think you're able to identify some areas that you're probably ignoring or at least not paying enough attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea was that to be a snapshot and a guide for you to say, okay, well, perhaps I should pay attention to a little bit more to these things. And as the other aspects of the book, and we can talk about how you respond to that is very important. You know, if you try to make a big New Year's resolution, huge change sort of thing, that's not a good idea. We can talk about that. But the whole idea is that it's never too late. Lifestyle is the major generator. What does your lifestyle look like? And where are your risks? And how can you lower those risks?
And really, my two risks were, one, being heavier today by about 30 pounds than I was in high school, but then this idea of stress. And I just want to challenge all my listeners, stop being so stressed. You know, everybody, listen to what Dr. Landry is telling us. Dr. Landry, you indicate in the book that stress is the great killer. I agree with you. I'm under a lot of stress. You know, I have two sons and they're busy and we need to kind of get them out and get them going. But for one reason or another, how do we get rid of all this stress?
Well, I lament with you. I'm in there with you. In fact, probably everybody who lives in our Western society and probably most of the world actually is under much greater stress than our ancestors were. And since we have the same physiology that they did, because our physiology doesn't change that much, we're subjecting ourselves to something they never experienced. And it is, I like to say, rotting us from within. The thing, Paul, with stress is that the stress response was meant to save us in an emergency. So it's when something threatens our life, or we perceive it to, it's kind of all hands on deck. Our brain sends out signals, and adrenaline, cortisol, and everything responds so that we are the strongest and the fastest we could possibly be to fight or to flee from this threat. But that was meant to be very short term. But we as humans, with our larger brains, have the ability, God bless us, or the opposite, to generate this fight or flight response, which is meant to be short term. We generate it with our thoughts, with our worry. And so it becomes a chronic process. It's like flooring the gas on a car and stepping on the brake. And it just really, this is what it does. The fact is, when it really comes down to it, the stress that most of us feel is self-generated. It is generated by our thoughts. It is generated by our response to situations in life. And it is tremendously destructive to our physiology, which was never meant to deal with this. Really, if there's a stressful thing in our lives, there's always something. So there's really only three things that you can do with that. One is that you can, fix it. Just fix it so that it ends, or make a plan to fix it, and then you periodically go to the plan and do something to hopefully eventually get rid of it. That's the first thing. The second thing is to just walk away from it. I don't need this in my life, and I'm just going to walk away, and this won't be a stress for me anymore. Those two are kind of difficult, and so the third one is probably the one that most of us should use and don't, and that is to accept it. To accept this as reality. It is what it is. Why labor about it? Why have it in our thoughts all the time? Why being taken out of this present moment, this beautiful present moment where life is meant to be lived, and be thinking about this thing, which is causing all the cortisol, all the adrenaline, all of these things that aren't meant to be there all the time, that it decreases our immune system, makes us at higher risk for cancers and heart disease and even dementia. See, in the brain, parts of the brain are adversely affected by chronic stress. And so that's the first thing. We are a stressful society, but we don't have to be. It's in many ways, it's a choice in how we see the world. Now, I'm no Pollyanna about this, Paul. This is tough. This is not something easy to do. But I think there are ways to combat that, if you'd like to discuss this.
I would. And as a matter of fact, I thought one of the most brilliant ways, because I think some of us can even get stressed about trying to get rid of the stress. But your suggestion about just simply breathing is just a wonderful way of thinking about it. We obviously have to do that, but there's a way to do it. And tell us a little bit about what that means, to breathe.
In a general sense, any lifestyle change we want to make should be very small. The smallest possible thing we could do to work towards a greater goal, and that should be our goal. And for stress, I think it's, how can I get 5 seconds, 5 seconds of a calm, peaceful moment where I have awareness, but without thought or without judgment. I'm here in this moment. We all hear about being in the present moment. Well, when we are, say we see a beautiful sunset or a beautiful piece of art, or we're in nature, or we're with an animal, or with a child, or music, we feel these moments of it's almost sublime. It is a beautiful, beautiful place to be. And yet with our thoughts and stress and our worry, we continually rip ourselves out of those. So a good, quick, easy to do start is to take just a small bite. Say, can I get 5 seconds of peace? Now, if you talk to an artist, say, and you ask them, what happens to time when you're drawing? And they'll say, time goes away. Well, you know, you can't be stressed if there's no sense of time. It's basically impossible unless some tiger is about to jump on you or something. And so finding a pursuit, and I ask them how they feel, and they say, I feel joyful. I feel happy and peaceful. This is being in the moment. And these little moments, although we can't have them all the time, it would be beautiful. I think our ancestors pretty much came close to that, but we can't. Those little moments sort of reboot us and reset the clock so that there's not this momentum building of stress and more stress and more stress on that. And so we can step back for a minute. So, you know, anything, art, a walk in nature, meditation is meant for this. And that was the breathing thing. Just pay attention to our breathing for 5 seconds without thought or judgment. Small steps, but when we realize that we're the ones responsible for most of the stress in our lives in reality, and that there are ways for us to step back from this, just little small steps that can be tremendously advantageous. Well, That's news to most of us.
We are with Dr. Roger Landry, author of Live Long, Die Short. One of the things that I so enjoyed about the book, too, was this group of 10 tips that you've listed that really allow us to achieve this authentic health and successful aging. The first one is use it or lose it. What does that mean?
Well, you know, we probably heard our grandmothers or great-grandmothers say this to us, and I think intuitively we have a sense of what this means, that we can't expect to be able to do something unless we do it. From a physiologic standpoint, say we learn a skill, we can naturally now on brain scans see neural pathways being built as we learn a new skill. And as we continue to do that skill, that little pathway becomes a road and then becomes a superhighway. And this is when we're particularly adept at something. And this is a motor skill, but it could be also be an intellectual skill. But our brain reflects that. Now, if we don't use that skill, we actually can see on brain scans those pathways getting smaller. And there's a thing called synaptic pruning. It doesn't matter what basically is happening. Is that your brain is disengaging one neuron from another neuron to allow us to do this skill. So eventually we can't do it. Now, that's on a physiologic, neurologic basis. But, we've all experienced it. Maybe shooting basketball, we're good at it. We don't shoot for a long time, we're not good at it. You know, we do mental math. If we don't do it, we can't do it as well. I know sometimes I go on vacation and sort of just sit back and practice what I preach about stress and just being in the moment. And when I get back, I kind of have difficulty finding a word sometimes for a presentation. It doesn't come quite so quickly because, again, I haven't been thinking in terms of vocabulary and words and communicating ideas. And it's okay for me to do that. But this is what this is all about. And it's a physical sense. It's an intellectual sense. Social skills. Our social skills fade as we don't use them. And certainly from the point of view of our meaning and purpose in life, to the extent we just sort of wander answering whatever challenge comes to us without a real sense of where we want to go and what our life is about, I think we pay for that because we're not really using this great advantage we have of when we have purpose. It gives us a sort of like a lighthouse, a guiding pathway to where our life wants to be.
I have to tell you, too, one of the other things that I really was struck by in the assessment portion, the inventory assessment, was your mention of this idea of social connection and spending more time with people. And in particular, it was, you know, when was the last time you spent a little time with a child? And I just thought to myself, I'm a church-going guy, and I know that as I see those young people all around us, I just think that's a wonderful thing for any age group to be surrounded by multiple ages. And this idea of a social connection is a strong one. You really go so far as to say that the research is showing that you'll live longer with a deeper social connection. Tell us a little bit about an example of a social connection in a modern setting. I mean, certainly a religious group is one, and there are others.
Yes, well, you're absolutely correct. This is something that is inherent in us as a creature. Our ancestors banded together, and that approach allowed us to survive as a species. We would not have survived had we not become social creatures and worked together. And so it is inherent in who we are. It's in our very DNA. And certainly, maybe some of our old Western movies think, you know, that the hero is this guy detached and somewhat you looked up to because of that. And this is nonsense. Who we are, certainly people can be annoying and we need our alone time, as we discussed with stress and everything. Mm-hmm. But we must be with humans if we're going to be humans. The Maasai say we're not human unless we're with other humans. And this is critically important. In our society, what we call social connection now, you know what I'm talking about, you know, having 1,000 friends, you know, who you never laid eye on or touch. Our socialization is primarily formed and framed by our ancestors, and we are meant to be, basically, from a physical standpoint, around a fire, looking at each other. And as our ancestors were. But no, out there, seeing it, this is the most beneficial. Certainly, it can be a great help to be connected to people over the internet, and certainly for people who are housebound. But to have that as a substitute for sitting at a table, looking in someone's eye, you know, we've read the statistics that 60 to 70% of communication is nonverbal. Well, to have that happen, you really need to be in someone's presence for the most part. So examples, the intergenerational example that you mentioned is a particularly great one, because this is happening less and less in our society. As we age, as we get marginalized, we get more isolated from everybody, but particularly from younger generations. And this is something that is an inherent need that we have. And it's, I think, children and young adults need it more than ever, because the wisdom and guidance that we talked about before is of critical importance. And older adults certainly need it, because it is the sort of thing that keeps them engaged in society. It is related, as you say, to health. We can now measure immune systems are much more powerful when someone is socially connected. We have babies surviving, premature babies have a better survival in neonatal intensive care when they are touched a lot. Women who've had breast cancer do better depending upon how many friends they have. Men who come back from a heart attack to a house where there's no one living are 5 times as likely to have a second heart attack than those who come back where people are. We're meant to be with people. Long-term study shows we're anywhere from 2 to 5 times higher, more likely, to be afflicted with heart disease, cancer, and dementia to the extent that we're not connected. And the opposite is true, 2 to 5 times less likely if we are connected. And so this is inherent in who we are. We are herd animals, and this is a very basic need that we have. And to allow society to, for the general default position, so to speak, for an older adult now is to get more and more isolated. We have to fight against that as a society with public policy, but as individuals and for those that we know and love, to keep them engaged in society.
We're talking to Live Long, Die Short author Roger Landry, who is a man of great wisdom. And I just want to tell you again, Dr. Landry, I appreciate you being here with us. I think you're right. I think we are who we are. That's an oft-used saying, I think, these days, but I am a believer in that. And I think that I personally am always very candid and open about my own age. I'm 59, but I never really try to act my age. And I thought that that was an interesting point that you make in the book, too. So tell us a little bit about what that really means to, you know, it's not about fibbing, but it's just about making sure to, you know, kind of be alive, really, I think. Is that a good way of putting it?
Paul, you're absolutely right. We seem to be programmed from our youth to act our age. We're told that by teachers and parents and things. But to act our age today is to buy into a stereotype that is still the preeminent position, and our policy, our national policy reflects it, and our beliefs believe it, that aging is mostly about decline. The term ageism, which is basically a bias against older adults, ageism is still alive, and yet the biggest repository for it is in older adults themselves. Mm-hmm. Older adults who set low expectations for themselves as they age, and you know, it's a matter of programming and expectation that has been sort of drilled into them, or they have observed as they have gotten older, and maybe just giving up. As long as we have a pulse, we should be growing. And to the extent growing, and we're going to have challenges, and maybe take Stephen Hawking. Look at the limitation he had. He's paralyzed except for his lips, and yet he's supposed to live only about a year, and he's still alive with us and has given us contributions of our knowledge of the universe. I mean, yeah, there's going to be challenges, but we should always be growing physically, mentally, socially, and spiritually, or at least some of those. And to the extent that we set low expectations for ourselves, and that's probably what's going to happen. So being optimistic, fighting to stay engaged, having a good sense of self-worth that you do have something to say, and you know, I'm fighting for changing our public policy so that it's more easy to give that opinion and where people will listen. But this is what's ahead for us, and I'm very optimistic about it, that older adulthood in our society is going to significantly change. The demographic will drive it, but I think that we're going to see that there's great value to not ignoring this great source of human capital.
The ways that we engage and kind of are willing to remain active. We don't all have to be doing 45 minutes or 60 minutes of aerobics. We can use the power of games and puzzles and maybe even learning a new language. My mother, who's 87 years old, still plays the accordion and is able to lift that heavy instrument and use her mind to adjust the keys on two different sides. And I just see tremendous value in her mental capability as a result of just some of those things. And you talk an awful lot about these different ways to engage ourselves, that deterioration is something that we can put off.
Definitely. And what you're observing, I see it so often. You know, we do see the stories of skydivers at 95, water skiers, and mountain climbers. Yes, and that's great. But in many ways, that's detrimental to the general adoption of the understanding that we can grow no matter how old we are. We don't have to be Olympic style. We don't have to be exotic about it. If we just keep moving, if we continue to learn new things, however small or large, if we stay connected to others and we have a reason to get out of bed every day with meaning and purpose, that is a magic formula, certainly for quality of life, no doubt about that. And probably for, definitely less likelihood to be afflicted with chronic diseases and really, really seriously limiting things. But more importantly, probably quantity of life also, but quality. So you can get the quantity, and we are living longer, but it's not necessarily higher quality, especially in those last decade or two. So it's absolute. The small things that in every aspect of our lives, physical, mental, social, and spiritual, or if one is severely limited in the others, like Stephen Hawking, well, that's the magic formula, and it's not rocket science, and it's not difficult to do either.
I noticed on your website a great deal of research, and I want to touch on that just for a little bit, and then we'll wrap up, because I do have a policy question that I do want to ask you. But I know that as a physician, you've spent a long time studying the human body, and even the lay person knows today that dementia can come on because of many things, the chemicals in our lives, enter our bloodstream and organs, and maybe even stress aggravates all of that stuff. But with regard to the research, it appears that there is scientific evidence that shows that we can strengthen the brain, we can heal organs, we can see other positive cognitive results from these lifestyle changes, right?
Absolutely right. You are absolutely correct. You know, for the longest time, we felt that we were just victims, you know, that we were struck with dementia, struck with Alzheimer's, and there wasn't much that we could do about it. What we know now and have seen from very, very strong, repeatable, and we see a new study every day that shows us that the role of lifestyle is so huge. We have discovered that the brain, unlike the way I learned it in medical school, is somewhat of a static organ. Once we were mature, it was mostly just you were just losing neurons. Well, we know now that the brain has a quality called neuroplasticity. And basically, this is the brain's ability to respond to challenges, to respond to the environment, to respond to things we ask it to do. And now that we can scan brains, we can actually see brains responding. Say, you want to take on a new language, Paul. Well, if we scan your brain and then you start learning this language, we can see your brain getting heavier and thicker in certain areas. And these are new neural pathways. Now, these neural pathways, we're learning from other research, seem to be associated with less likelihood for developing the symptoms of dementia. In fact, there was a nun study in Minnesota where they studied nuns who were very physically and mentally active, and I'll explain why that's important. And when they died, several of them had Alzheimer brains with the deposits and the plaques and the tangled nerves, and yet they didn't have symptoms. And so the research is concluded, and now this is mainline research, that lifestyle, a certain lifestyle, has the possibility of, even if we have the disease anatomically, even if we have a propensity to develop it, that we can forestall the onset of those symptoms with our lifestyle. And that lifestyle is one of being physically active, because we need to get blood up to the brain in order to do all this. If we're going to be the architects of our brain, which we really are, we need blood up there. And the second thing is that we challenge our brain, not only by doing the things that we always do, like a use it or lose it thing, but more importantly, that we learn new things. We don't have to become experts. We don't have to, you know, win a blue ribbon or a gold medal. Just to try new things, skills and words, and that makes all the difference. And again, we're the architects of our brain, and it's much, much more optimistic. A lifestyle can actually cause some genes that would otherwise cause us to get diseases to not express themselves and to actually sleep. This is hugely optimistic for the brain and for many other diseases.
It is optimistic. And I think it's also something that as a society look at some of these issues around ageism, perceptions of seniors, hopefully giving seniors and those over the age of 55 maybe a different look. I think this is all so important. I think the other thing that you've touched on a couple times in our conversation today, and I read a little bit about this in the book, you know, as I sit here just outside of Washington, D.C., you know, I'm thinking, Well, what is it the government should be doing that fits with what you're suggesting? How can government play more of a role in this, Dr. Lander?
Well, government seems to have a bad name these days, and maybe some of it's deserved because it doesn't seem to be responding the way we need. But we're looking at a huge demographic shift with more and more older adults. Very soon, every fifth older adult will be over 65. We're looking at a time when only three people will be working for every one on Social Security. And we're looking at more and more needs in our country, you know, struggling mothers with no child care, young people who seem to be unable to find someone to guide them, the mentor. We're looking at children struggling, not only in school, but in social skills. We're looking at a basic structure from the outdoor trails to our cities, you know, what they look like, you know, but there's challenges with our very substructure of our country. And then on the other hand, as we talked about before, we have this huge source of wisdom, in many cases, actual physical abilities and a great desire and actually a need to be engaged and to do something in order to be healthier. And this is kind of like a match made in heaven if we can break down barriers that now look at older adults as just accounts payable or as people on the margins of society who we just take care of, rather than seeing them not as the source of the problem, but as the potential solution to the problem. Now, I'm not saying necessarily just continuing to work the way they did, but I'm saying to use the skills and the passion that they have to break down barriers. Now, that could be something like having a national registry of people who are willing to share their abilities, say their professional abilities, with younger professionals and being able to match them up. We're looking at women, young wives, particularly young single parents, looking for childcare, not being able to find it, and having millions of proven child raisers and grandparents who would love the opportunity. And yes, there are legal battles now, liability and other things. Well, we can get rid of that if we have the will. And that would be a win-win that would be knocked out of the park. Those are just a few examples, but, you know, there's just a huge source of human capital that is ready, willing, and able, and we just have to sort of clear the way for it.
Well, thank you for those examples. And for my audience, it is a terrific book. You will find more of those examples and more from Dr. Roger Landry in his book, Live Long, Die Short, A Guide to Authentic Health and Successful Aging. Dr. Landry has a very impressive list of credentials, and I just want to tell you again how much I enjoyed talking to you, not only in terms of what a great program this has been, and I know my audience will love it, but in terms of my own life, I know I've got some room to, you know, make some improvements. But thank you so much. We're out of time. Dr. Landry, I'm looking forward to seeing you soon in Washington, D.C., but I want to thank you for joining us today again. Live Long, Die Short, A Guide to Authentic Health and Successful Aging. I'm so delighted we've been able to spend some time together, Dr. Landry. Thank you.
An honor and a privilege, Paul. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks, sir.